Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca and my co-host, Michelle Chosudovsky. Today, we go back to the global economic crisis, a recurring topic in this program as well it should be. It's grave. It may be the gravest ever. We'll have to wait for more of it to unfold before we really know that. But at the very least, it's the worst crisis we've faced since the 1930s. And discussions in this program have covered the effect that the programs under the Obama administration have not really been doing very much to correct the problem, maybe making it worse. Today, my guest is Richard Wolff, Professor Richard Wolff. Rick is an economics professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. He's now teaching in Manhattan at the New School University and also at the Brecht Forum. He's always writing, and he's making documentaries on the global economic crisis. He has one out, and another is planned for this summer. He's done so much writing over vital topics for over 40 years. And once it gets in your blood, Rick, I know it never goes away. It's infected me only over the past few years. But you've devoted a lifetime to it. And your theme that we can talk about today, we've discussed it when you were on the program before. You refer, it's a wonderful theme. You talk about capitalism hitting the fan. Oh, how it's ever done that. And you have a solution of what we need to do. I guess we need responsible people in government to implement that solution. But let's talk about the problem, Rick, and the solution. Welcome you. I welcome you back very warmly.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, Rick, it's a great pleasure to have you on. Let's talk about, if you remember when you were on last time, when we hiss off music, we'll have a break coming, so I'll interrupt. But talk about your theme of capitalism hitting the fan and how we got to where we are today.
Well, I think it becomes even more important as time passes to grasp that this is a long maturing crisis. That is, its roots go back a long time and they sink very deep. And the reason that's important to keep in mind is it cautions us all against imagining that we're going to get any kind of quick fix here, that it's going to be possible to kind of kickstart, because I see that phrase in the press so often, kickstart our economy so we kind of pick up where we left off in late 2007, before, as the film says, capitalism hit the fan. Let me stress two points. A long development of our society, of America, of the United States, was built around increasing the productivity of American workers by improving the machines they worked with, by making them work harder and faster. But we paid workers, in a sense, a kind of compensation for the harder work they did and the greater productivity they achieved by giving them rising wages. And it became the crucial thing about American economic history that for 150 years, roughly from 1820 to 1970, which is the bulk of the United States' existence as a nation, we were able to deliver to the American working class a rising level of wages and a standard of living. In the 1970s, employers who had hoped to be able to do this sooner finally got their dream, no longer to raise real wages. Between the rising use of the computer to substitute for people, between moving jobs to other countries to take advantage of lower wages there, with the arrival of immigrants and the growth of women wanting paid work, all those conditions made it possible for employers no longer to raise wages.
Rick, we need to take a break. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Rick Wolff. We're talking about the global economic crisis and capitalism hitting the fan. Rick, I remember so well as I was growing up, a young guy, 1940s, 1950s, and then off to work after getting an MBA in 1960. It'll be my 50th anniversary next February. I got it in mid-year, finished up at the end of 1959. My goodness, Eisenhower was still president at that time, and went to work for the first time in 1960. I remember so clearly, literally burned into my mind, that every generation could look forward to doing better than the previous one. And I think parents looked at their children as now having even a greater opportunity than they had. And as you say, beginning in the 1970s, that all got turned in its head. Let me let you continue.
Okay. It was a trauma for American workers. They didn't know it because there was no public discussion that the world had changed. There was no public debate about what it would mean and what it would do to the American people. So what each individual family did was try to cope on its own. And basically what the American family did is two things. It sent more people out to work, particularly mothers, but everybody took more jobs. And number two, it borrowed money like no working class in the history of the world. And for the next 25 years, in a sense, the American working class postponed the day of reckoning of the end of real wage increases, the end of rising ability to pay for your goods and services by what you earned, and instead you exhausted yourself with extra labor to earn more and you borrowed money. At the end of 30 years, that is now, after doing that, the American working class is completely exhausted. It's physically exhausted from all the work it does. Americans work 20% more per year on average than, say, people in Germany or France or Italy. And number two, the American family is emotionally stressed because the mothers all went out to work, those that hadn't been working before. Part-timers took full-time jobs. They can't hold together the family, which the women traditionally did. And finally, everybody is anxiety-ridden about levels of debt that are astronomic. Just one statistic. Going into this economic crash of capitalism, the average level of debt of an American family is about 140% of its annual income. In the 1929 period, before the last big crash of capitalism, the average level of debt of an American family was about 30% of its annual income. That's a staggering difference. And if you understand that the mass of people are physically exhausted, emotionally stressed, and anxiety-ridden about their debt, you understand we have to deal with those underlying problems and not by throwing money at banks and insurance companies, because unless people are willing to borrow again, which the American people cannot and will not do, then giving money to banks and insurance companies is not going to get the economy going again, because you haven't dealt with the underlying problem, which has to do with the relationship between employer and employee and how much you pay people for the work they do as opposed to forcing them into debt, et cetera, et cetera. And those issues are not being dealt with. They weren't dealt with by the Bush administration, and they aren't being dealt with by the Obama administration, who all want us to go, quote unquote, back to where we were, back to normal. But the joke is, even if Obama and his team were to succeed and somehow get the economy going again by having banks lend and people borrow, given that we're already over-indebted, that will just bring us right back into the disaster that we got the last time. It's not an intelligent, it's not a viable solution, and even if it works, it'll kind of plunge us right back in. And that's why it's so important to understand that history, because it gets you to the point of recognizing that a kind of structural change to the system we live in is the only way we're going to get out of this crisis.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it really is staggering that this kind of massive wealth transfer, I think this is all deliberate, Rick, just a plot, a scam to transfer the wealth of the great majority of people to bankers that got us into this mess in the first place. And if every one of the major banks in trouble now suddenly became solvent and could go back literally to do the kind of lending business they did in the past, well, who's there to borrow the money? Households, as you say, are so maxed out, so over-indebted, that they're trying somehow, some way, to get out of debt. But, of course, we have the problem of people losing their jobs. I saw a statistic that said roughly every 5 seconds somebody loses a job. You've got that. You've got millions of home foreclosures. People wouldn't quite, if they wanted to borrow money, which most people don't want to do because they're trying to get out of debt. But if they wanted to borrow money, too many, maybe most, won't qualify because their current situation won't allow them to qualify. What bank, what sensible banker will lend money to anybody who they think may not be able to pay them back? So the whole system is clogged down. It's not a matter of getting the banks more able to lend. It's a matter of making households healthy enough to be able to go out and borrow because they may want to borrow and maybe do it more sensibly than they did before. And the same thing goes for businesses. Why should businesses invest more in capital equipment to expand when the market they serve, us, is not in a position to go out and buy their products and services the way we did a few years ago?
Right. And that, so if you're going to get the thing going again, if you're going to revive the economy, you have to face up finally to the issues that built up over the last period of time and that are not going to go away now. There is no new bubble that we can all invest in and postpone the way we did after the stock market crashed in the year 2000. We had this real estate bubble that carried us another few years. But we've run out of bubbles, not that they're good ways of solving problems in the first place, but we've run out of them, and now we kind of stare into the abyss, and much of the running around and waving of hands and gnashing of teeth in Washington is this disguise for a desperate effort to kind of keep it all going by making the banks flush and hoping that by the magic bullet of refinancing the banks, everything else will fall into place, but everything else won't because everything else is exhausted by all of the postponement of facing up to the reality that we've had. And so I think we're going to, my fear is that we're going to go into a kind of tailspin here in which the policies don't work, but there hasn't been the kind of debate about the more serious structural changes we need to go into so that nobody is prepared for what to do when this current crop of financial machinations doesn't do the trick.
And, Rick, even worse than that, the idea of bailing out the banks, let's say all the plans work wonderfully and the banks offload, a trillion, two, three, 5 trillion, even 10 trillion worth of debt. The amount of derivatives that they hold on their books, and no doubt a large percentage of them are damaged at the least, and maybe very, very toxic at the most. And I've seen numbers if I can recollect them. J.P. Morgan Chase has the greatest number, something like $80 or $90 trillion worth of derivatives. I think Citigroup is next. With 30 or $40 trillion worth of derivatives. And then it goes lower after that. But I think Bank of America may be the next biggest one in trouble. The biggest bank, because of this, they're all insolvent. So what if you relieve a couple of trillion dollars worth of this problem? Well, what are you going to do about all the rest?
Right. But even that, our difficulties mean even that itself sets into motion new problems. For the government, for example, even to do what it is now proposing to do under Obama has two key problems associated with it. First, the government hopes, the United States government, that it can pay for all of these guarantees, all of these bailouts, all of these stimuluses, all of these public-private partnerships, as they call them, by borrowing money. But the great unanswered question is, are there enough folks out there in the world able and willing to lend money to the United States government in those quantities when we remember that the United States is already the biggest debtor country in the planet by a wide margin and that there's growing questions about the ability of the United States to pay back this mountain of money that they now propose adding to by vast new borrowings if the rest of the world is not willing to lend to the United States unlimited amounts of money, then the program that has been announced can't be put into effect in the first place. The second issue is, if the government can't find enough people to lend, will it be tempted, as it has already begun to do, to create the money by printing it to do these things since it can't borrow it? In which case, we have a classic risk that's going to affect every investor of an inflation, of too much money chasing after a shrinking amount of goods being produced in America. And then everybody's going to start worrying and taking steps to accommodate an inflation, which typically brings it to pass. So we have enormous dangers in the very programs being pursued now, as well as the underlying question that they may not be the right programs in the right quantities to deal with these underlying structural problems in the first place.
Oh, absolutely, Rick. We got into trouble inflation-wise in the mid-late 1960s and 1970s because I guess too much money printing, too much spending. At least some of it was good. Certainly not the war spending, but the Great Society spending was good. We didn't do enough of that, and we did too much for Vietnam. But we got into a terrible inflationary problem in the 70s and early
80s. Right, and one of the reasons, if I could interrupt, one of the reasons for that terrible inflation that we had in the later 60s and early 70s had precisely to do with a political decision, as we are now seeing a political decision about how to deal with this crisis. And when I say political, I don't just mean what the politicians do, but what the business community and the media support. In the late 60s and 70s, the plan was to fight a very unpopular and extremely expensive war in Vietnam.
Oh, indeed, Rick, I have to interrupt. We're going to break away, and then you pick it up as soon as we come back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Rick Wolf. Rick, let me make one quick comment, and then you continue where you left off. I wanted to stress that as excess as the spending was in the late 60s to the mid-70s, it was nothing. It was nothing compared to today. In my newest article, I talk about the new Geithner plan, the PPIP plan. I use the number $12.5 trillion, either allocated, guaranteed, or given away. On Bloomberg today, March 31st, they have the number, it keeps going up daily, they have the number at $12.8 trillion. I can't even conceive of numbers like this, but please continue.
Yeah, my only point was that when you tried to finance the war in Vietnam, not by taxing the American people, because if you had taxed them, then the opposition would have been twice as strong and the war would never have been able to be pursued. So you financed the war in Vietnam basically by government borrowing, postponing the problem to the future. But government borrowing has a nasty habit of becoming inflationary as the Federal Reserve does what it is supposed to do and basically prints money and buys back the Treasury securities that the Treasury issued to pay for the war. And we now have a situation where the government is again under enormous pressure, this time not to fight a war that they don't want to pay taxes or raise taxes to pay for, this time to deal with an economic crisis of much greater proportions, as your numbers show. And so the temptation will rise again, as it always has, to pump up the money supply as a way of trying to stimulate the economy and paying for all these government bailouts. It is a very dangerous situation, as is the effort to borrow for it in the first place. And since all of these, as I want to stress, are substitutes for dealing with the underlying problem of a population that does not get enough jobs, paying enough wages to be able to sustain the economic situation, it's going to be very serious if the United States wends its way towards a solution that basically says to the mass of the American workers, okay, the party is over. We're not going to pay you more wages. You can't afford to maintain the borrowing level you have. as we all now know. And so you're going to be unable to borrow more, and we're not going to raise the wages. So finally, your standard of living is going to enter into a long-term period of decline. You're going to have to deleverage, it's called, borrow less, reduce your debt. And you, since your income isn't going up, the only way to do that is to lower the standard of your consumption and your life. And you're going to become more like the working classes in many other parts of the world that are less well-heeled and cannot afford all the benefits that you have had. And instead of having one generation live better than the next, we're heading into a time where generations live more poorly than the one before them. The problem in the United States is we have a culture and a politics that is premised on the reverse, on rising standards of living. And it is an unknown question what masses of people will do, what they will believe, what they will demand, who they will get angry at, as they are confronted, and as usual, without public debate, with a steady erosion of their opportunities and their standards of living. This translates into a million little moments in people's living rooms as parents explain to children that they can't afford a higher education for them and that therefore their life chances and their job opportunities are going to be much less attractive than what had been the case. It's when older folks confront children who can't help take care of them at a time when Social Security benefits do not enable you to live a decent life, et cetera, et cetera. These countless moments will produce in a population already stressed and tension-ridden in the ways I've described, it's going to produce a tinderbox, and a tinderbox in which scapegoating will become fashionable again as people look around for who to blame, and crises proliferate that I don't even want to think about, but I fear where they take us, and I fear what they represent. And it's clear in my mind that a much better solution would be one that begins to face up to our structural problems and has the creativity of the American people debating how to deal with them, how to rearrange corporations so they do not stop raising wages even though workers' productivity keeps rising, that they do not put workers in the position of substituting borrowing for rising wages to pay for their standard of living, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the difficult questions, often rendered taboo in our culture from conversation. But if we don't deal with them, we're not going to have an arsenal of tools to deal with the failure that the current policies, I believe, will present to us.
Well, I see it too, Rick. And we will have a future program on an article that my co-host, GlobalResearch.ca editor Michelle Chosadowski wrote. His article is called Preparing for Civil Unrest in America. It's a terrific article and an important one to read. It's in the top section of the globalresearch.ca website. And I've written a little bit about it. He wrote a full, detailed article about it. But a shocking fact, and we need to break again, FEMA, supposedly there to help in emergencies, they are in charge of 800 detention camps in every state in the country, 800. These are concentration camps who has wrecked their lives, and they're protesting. So our response is lock them up in concentration camps.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Rick Wolf. We're talking about the global economic crisis. Rick, I think what scares me the most is the planned response, what the government has at the ready to respond to what they see coming, civil unrest. It's hard to imagine that it's already happening. There is, to some degree, some civil disobedience going on. It doesn't get much, if any, play in the major news, but it's beginning, and as this crisis deepens, and it absolutely will, and more people lose their homes, their jobs, their savings, everything, they have to do something. They need to react when they see their government isn't doing anything to help them. I'm working on an article comparing Roosevelt's New Deal in his first 100 days versus what Obama is doing in his first 100 days. Well, he's got 3 weeks to go. and I'll wait. I'll give him the full 100 days before I bring down my hammer on him. But so far, it's a pretty dismal opposite of what Roosevelt did in his first 100 days. What we need is a new deal, but we're not getting it.
Right. You can see here in the United States, and I find it very troubling. There have been now in a number of countries, and I'm thinking particularly of France and Ireland, extraordinary actions by the organized working class. In both those countries, trade unions have led the movement for general strikes. A couple of weeks ago in France, 2.5 million people took to the streets. That's an extraordinary number, especially when you remember that the French population is less than half of the American, a good bit less, a third of the American or less. And in Ireland as well, that there's been an unprecedented level of unity in the trade union movement and with left political organizations that are important in both those countries. And we see already a sign that working people are very clear that they are angry about how their governments are responding or not responding to the deteriorating economic situation. And I find it extraordinary that these unprecedented mass movements are virtually ignored in the American press and media. You get very little coverage. It's hard to come away from looking at this without the impression that not only are the American people less mobilized and less active against a series of economic problems and solutions that don't work than other people in other parts of the world, but that there's almost a campaign here not to give American workers the model, the idea, the example of what is going on in other parts of the world. You know, the results are very tangible. In France, for example, workers cannot be fired and laid off the way they can in this country. They simply can't. They have too many guarantees, too many protections. The government there cannot do what is being done in this country. And even though the situation for working people is better there, they are more vigilant as a result. And so the government cannot simply throw money at banks and let everybody else's situation deteriorate. And I fear that here in the United States, it may take longer for the working people to be. But when they do, we're going to see this thing happening really fast, and it's going to frighten people in the United States. And maybe that's why those camps are being readied, that there's a vague sense, or not so vague, that we're heading into a very serious problem. Let me stress it in one other way. Over the last 30 years, in addition to everything else we've discussed, there has been a drastic growth in the inequality of both wealth and income in the United States. 30 years ago, the United States was a more equalized country. That is, the gap between rich and poor was smaller in the United States than it was in most of the countries of Europe. Over the last 30 years, that relationship has been reversed. The United States is now the most unequally distributed wealth and income. The gap between rich and poor in our society exceeds that in most every other country in the advanced industrial world. And that means a polarization. That means a resentment. That brings the kinds of social problems to a head that you can postpone, but you cannot, in the end, evade. And while it's better to deal with them sooner than later, we're not doing that. And the result is to plunge our society into a very dangerous situation with an unstable political situation. It is very, very fraught. And that's why, again, I would hammer home, why don't we ask questions like I try to ask in that film I produced, which is why I produced the film, the question toward the end, which says, suppose workers were no longer the people who had to live with the decisions of corporations, but could become, as is the premise of democracy, participants in the decisions whose consequences they have to live with. Why do boards of directors have to be groups of people, 15 to 20 in number, that are responsible to shareholders, but not responsible to the mass of the workers who depend on them? If we had workers in charge of our corporations, if they had an equal share with, say, shareholders, or a bigger share than shareholders in deciding, one thing would be sure. In the 1970s, those workers, had they been in charge of the corporations, would not have stopped raising their own wages. They would have continued to raise their wages along with the productivity of their labor. And then we would not have plunged people into the need to work crazy hours. We would not have gone into debt the way we would. Our history would be different. So for that reason alone, thinking about reorganizing our businesses so that they're run differently and the decisions are made differently is one of the things we ought to be debating as a society to cope with our problem instead of pretending that we can just throw money at banks as a solution.
Rick, I absolutely don't want to forget to tell listeners how they can get your current DVD and the new one when it comes out this summer. So let's do that now so I don't forget it. How can people get hold of your DVD? It goes into this in great detail.
Right, and it's done with all the graphic bells and whistles that filmmakers now can produce. The simplest way is to go to the web, www.capitalismhitsthefan.com. You go there, it'll give you a little preview, it'll explain it all, and there's a simple way to order the DVD, and it's shipped to you overnight. You get it right away. And I think you will find it an instructive way to deal with these questions, to deal with them on a fundamental level. And if you watch it with a few other people, you will have a very useful discussion of the sort you can't really have any other way, as you get stimulated by that. And I'm running all over the country kind of going to screenings and answering questions. And it's a wonderful experience as people kind of understand what the roots of this situation are and don't feel so mystified and so at sea about what it is and what it means for them and in their work lives.
Oh, fundamentally, Rick, obviously this is issue one for most people in the country, and it becomes more so as people worry that maybe today I'm going to walk in and there'll be that terrible slip on my desk saying,
right,
don't come in tomorrow, clean out your desk tonight, or something or other.
Right.
This is the big thing. People need to get all the information they can about this to arm themselves in our own self-defense, and call your DVD and a program like this an antidote to the CNNs and the Fox News and the New York Times and the BBC and the rest of them. If people have this information, it's not that hard to understand the basics of what's going on without getting very technical about it, without getting into all the fine points about the details of economics. It doesn't concern most people at heart. What's going on, and simply, what could we do to fix this problem?
Right.
The basic outline of the problem and the basic outline of the solution comes down to pretty simple stuff.
That's right. It's always that way, and We should always remember to be very suspicious when it gets very technical. Most of the time, that's not because it's necessary to solve the problem. It's usually more likely necessary to obfuscate and mystify the problem and make it the average people pretend that somehow they have to defer to the quote-unquote experts who tend to be in the pockets of those who don't want change. So you have to be very skeptical about that and demand that things be made simple, because that's the principle of democracy, that they be made simple enough and understandable enough that people can participate, because we really value that. If we're committed to this notion of democracy, as our leaders claim we are, then it ought to apply in economics and it ought to apply inside each business. The people, the majority, ought to decide in a business, and in most businesses, the majority are the people who come to work at 9 o'clock and go home at 5 and have to feed their families and have to make a life. And they ought to participate in decisions about what to produce, where to produce, how to produce, and most importantly, what to do with the profits that their businesses engender. And as long as we don't do that, as long as we allow those decisions to be made by boards of directors and shareholders, we're going to get ourselves into trouble. This is the second great crash of capitalism in the United States in 75 years. And we had a dozen so-called business downturns between the 1930s and now. That's not a record of an economic system that's working real well. That's not the record of an economic system about which we ought not to ask the question, can't we do better than this? And now we're going to be forced to ask that question.
Supposedly, the Federal Reserve was established in 1930 to smooth out the business cycle. Well, the business cycle has been more rocky ever since the Fed was created, not as a government agency, but as a privately owned banking cartel. And they basically, the bankers own the Federal Reserve, and the chairman and the governors are employees of the banking system, which I just loosely refer to as Wall Street. But we may have come to an important inflection point, Rick. I certainly hope so, or at least close to it, when maybe people will somehow come together like they really ever do and bring about change. Many months back, I had Frances Fox Piven on the program on a book she wrote 2-3 years ago called Challenging Authority, on the few times in the history of this country where people from the grassroots brought about change that never would have come from the top down. And one of the biggest, my goodness, was ending slavery, something that I think way back when was thought to be impossible to do.
Right.
You know, compromise with it, don't fight it. But my goodness, the work of enough people over enough period of time managed to end this terrible system. And we had the labor movement, another great achievement, civil rights. Women got the right to vote. We've had wonderful things happen, not because the politicians wanted to give it to us, but because enough people decided that they're not going to put up with this anymore, and they're going to keep working and fighting and so on until they get this. And finally, they brought the politicians around. This is what we need to do now.
Yeah, and I think that the deteriorating economic situation is already producing that kind of adjustment. The politicians are afraid at this point of a number of things, of people's anger at the bankers being the only one getting the big largesse of the government, that all the home people losing their homes are not getting anything like that, the people losing their jobs. There is the beginning of an anger. I just hope that some unscrupulous politicians do not take advantage of that and siphon it all off into scapegoating this or that particular group or this or that particular group of companies. This is a problem of the system we live in. That's why it keeps happening. That's why every president who's been dealing with a crisis, including Obama, explains that the policies he's pushing are going to not only solve the current crisis, but prevent these crises from happening in the future. Every single one of them promised it. Every single one of them could not deliver on that promise. And that's not because they weren't smart or clever or decent. It's because it's a problem of the system that isn't going to go away until we change this basic system and have the courage to talk about that and debate it and struggle and come up with new solutions. That's the most important thing that I think we need to do at this point.
Oh, absolutely, Rick. When you say the problem, you can call it a financial crisis, an economic crisis, but I think you hit on the key phrase. At its root, we're talking about a systemic crisis. There's something fundamentally wrong with a system that produces things like this and causes so much harm to so many people.
And over and over again.
Repeatedly. And they can get bigger. They all aren't bigger than the preceding ones. But here we have the terrible 1930s. I can actually remember when I was young and naive. I might have been a sophomore in college at the time, Rick. And the only economics course I took, I don't remember the precise name, but it was basically an economics 101 course. I can remember saying to my father, I don't know why I remember this, but I do, Dad, you never have to worry about going through the 1930s again, because we discovered all the things that went wrong and what made them go wrong, and we figured out the way to see to it that this doesn't happen again.
Right.
So, you know, we'll have recessions will come and go, but we'll never have another repeat of the Great Depression. Well, here we are today, possibly with an even greater depression.
That's right. And I think the lesson from that has to be drawn if we don't want to be left with the legacy of immense debts that our government is now taking in our name and that our taxes and will have to pay for in the years ahead, that it is taking enormous risks. You know, we have to be able to say, wait a minute, let's not do it again, when we discovered that the last time the promise of not having these crises wasn't delivered. Let's not blame anybody. We went through it. We learned from it. But, you know, you have no excuse for not learning when the procedures and programs you pursued didn't work. The thing that horrifies me about Obama is that he has collected around himself the same old economists, many of whom had worked for Clinton, who was part of the problem and not part of the solution, and they are now reinventing the same wheel that didn't work last time. And even if it gets us temporarily out of the crisis, we're going to be right back in the soup as we were last time if we don't learn to ask different questions and go much deeper in the way of solutions. The people who are sitting on top of this system don't want that. They like to sit there. They don't mind it. They get through these crises pretty nicely. But for the rest of the people, that's a luxury we cannot afford.
Oh, absolutely. Literally the same people who caused this problem, ending Glass-Steagall, this Commodity Futures Modernization Act, right at the end of the Clinton administration. These basically just stripped away the regulations and turned Wall Street into a casino. They could just do anything they pleased. And of course, they invented these wildly speculative things that brought us to where we are today. And here, the same gang, these same retreads are back in charge of the system. And the simple conclusion you have to draw, Rick, is, how can the people who caused this problem be the ones you would ever expect to be able to fix it?
Yeah. It's like a saying, let's have the General Motors people keep going and they'll come up with new subsidies, they'll come up with a new way. They've had 30, 40 years now of competition from the Japanese automakers. They couldn't produce a competitive car.
Oh, indeed. We need to break again, Rick. We'll come back for the final brief segment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the News Hour. Just a few minutes left, Rick. Quick comment, and I'll let you finish up. And again, mention how listeners can get your DVD and then the new one when it comes out. I'm very concerned about what's going on with the auto companies, too. And in my last article, I mentioned we've already handed them $42 billion to paper over their ineptitude and what they should have done but never did do. But what worries me the most now is, of course, Obama turned them down yesterday in all the public headlines. But I think you and I both know that what they really want to do is to make the workers pay the price for the company's failures. So cut wages, destroy benefits, turn the workers into third world country workers with nothing like they once had in the glory days of the past, and then use that, get them to do that, whether they go bankrupt or not. Use the auto industry as a model and sweep it over entire industry to destroy wages and benefits in other major industries. If the auto giants do it, and do it to the steel workers, do it to the chemical workers, do it to all kinds of other workers in manufacturing. They've already done it to the service workers.
Yeah, I think that's my fear that I referred to earlier, that we're in a period in which the bottom line, since they're not prepared to change the basic structure of our society to once again organize that workers get paid for the work they do and don't have to go into debt and all that implies. Instead, we're going to have the cutback of workers' standard of living. And the auto companies are a very dramatic public example of doing that. If the Obama administration goes through with this, and it has already now threatened to force the companies into bankruptcy, your listeners should understand that when you put a company into bankruptcy, the courts take over the enterprise from its private owners. That's what bankruptcy basically means. And the contracts of that entity are renegotiated. And the most important contract of General Motors and Chrysler and Ford, too, is the contract that each of them has with its employees. And if those are, quote, unquote, renegotiated, plain English, what that means is the company, in its reorganized form, doesn't have to pay the wages, doesn't have to provide the benefits that were in the old contract. And a new one is written up, and that is going to be to the great disadvantage. And there'll be a lot of the workers. There'll be a lot of talk about sharing sacrifice, but if you've ever been to Detroit, where the auto industry is based, you will know that the sacrifices have long been already shared with those people. It's one of the most depressed cities in the United States in terms of empty stores and empty streets and broken down neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very sorry spectacle of where the United States is going. And I think eventually most workers will much prefer, even if they're not used to it, to engaging in a political struggle to change the way this crisis is handled rather than facing an endless bleak prospect of declining standards of living as the solution that is built into this focus on throwing money at banks and financial markets.
Oh, indeed, Rick. We're almost out of time. Tell listeners again.
One last time to get the film, which I think will explain this thing and provoke discussion. www.capitalismhitsthefan.com, and you can get it that way, and it'll give you also a preview of it.
Oh, that's a perfect website title and so easy to remember. Rick, I hope you'll come back and we can continue this. This crisis is not going away in a hurry.
There'll be plenty of opportunity, and I would love any opportunity and any invitation you might care to provide.
Oh, Rick, I thank you so kindly for coming on. It's a terrific discussion. You're an important guest, and I absolutely want you back to continue this.
Oh, I'd love to come back. Thank you very much, Steve.
And we'll be back tomorrow. Another program, another discussion. My guest tomorrow is John McMurtry. John is another very, very distinguished professor emeritus. We'll have a free-ranging discussion that I know will get back into the global economic crisis. Probably foreign wars, militarism. We'll fill up the hour with very interesting discussion. Join us again.